taking their place in a long true line of everyday Americans,
helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors and have a few good friends. Every day you are everyday Americans.
Hello there, everyday Americans, and welcome to the Constitution Study. This is where we read and study the Constitution. Teach the rising generation to be free. We learn how to exercise our rights and protect them for ourselves. Now, I want to make a point that America is often referred to as a democracy. I hear it all the time by everybody from lawyers and politicians to media personnel and there's people on the street. They talk about America as a democracy. We're not. We're a republic. Now, Noah Webster defined a republic as a commonwealth, a state in which the exercise of sovereign power is lodged in representatives elected by the people. Which brings up an interesting question. What happens when the representatives we have set up, the structure for the representation that we have set up, well, isn't being followed? Now, most of you know that there are 435 members in the House of Representatives. But did you know that is actually a violation of the Constitution, that the Constitution has a much different number? So I did some research and I wrote this article on what's referred to as the Permanent Apportionment Act and the fact that it is being used to try to convince us that we are being properly represented in Washington, D.C., when actually we're not.
When you hear a lie so often that you think it's the truth, we say you've been gaslighted. That is just as true for government as any other part of your life. From early in the 20th century, Congress has been telling the American people the lie that they limited the number of members in the House of Representatives by law, even though that law is invalid and void. Yet the American people sit back and allow their employees in Congress to violate the law and do so with blatant disregard for the supreme law of the land and their oath or affirmation to support it. We act like the people in the Hans Christian Andersen tale, The Emperor's New Clothes. We nod our heads and go along with what we've been told our entire lives, that the House of Representatives legally has 435 members. I'm here to play the role of the small boy in the story and cry out, "The Emperor has no clothes." Specifically, the House of Representatives has denied you the proper representation you are entitled to in Congress, and it's about time we do something about it. Let's start this tale where all good stories should start. At the beginning, Article 6, Clause 2 of the Constitution states, "This Constitution and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary, notwithstanding." The Constitution of the United States is the supreme law of the land. Only laws of the United States made in pursuance of or following the Constitution are considered supreme as well. Any act of Congress that is not pursuant to the Constitution is repugnant or contrary to the supreme law of the land. According to the Supreme Court of the United States, such an act of Congress is void. It is empty. It is vacant. From the Marbury versus Madison opinion, "Thus, the particular phraseology of the Constitution of the United States confirms and strengthens the principle, supposed to be essential to all written constitutions, that a law repugnant to the Constitution is void, and that courts, as well as other departments, are bound by that instrument." This idea that the Constitution of the United States is the supreme law of the land is the bedrock to the rule of law, the concept of self-governance, and our constitutional republic. So when those in government violate the Constitution, they are not merely acting unconstitutionally. They are violating the law, exercising unjust powers, and stealing from the American people their ability to consent to the actions of their government. Which brings me to the Apportionment Acts that Congress has passed. Section 2 of the 14th Amendment reads, "Representatives shall be apportioned among the several states according to their respective numbers, counting the whole number of persons in each state, excluding Indians not taxed." Now, Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3 of the Constitution was amended by the 14th Amendment to remove the 3/5 clause, which limited the counting of non-free persons for the purposes of apportionment. The reason the federal government conducts a census every 10 years is because it's required by Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3 of the Constitution. To understand this apportionment of representatives, we have to understand why we have a bicameral national legislature. Many compromises had to be made in order for the Constitution to be signed and ratified. One of those compromises had to do with representation in Congress. See, large states wanted representation based on population, which would give them an advantage in Congress. Smaller states didn't like that idea and wanted equal representation among the states, which would give them and their citizens a greater say in legislation. The compromise was a bicameral or two-house legislature. How their members would be chosen, and most important to this discussion, the role of those houses. Now, Article 1, Section 1, Clause 1 of the Constitution reads, "All legislative power herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and House of Representatives." The very first legally binding line of the Constitution states that all legislative or lawmaking power would be vested in a Congress consisting of a Senate and House of Representatives. To understand the role of these two houses, we need to read the first line of the sections of Article 1 that creates them. Now, Section 2 starts with, "The House of Representatives shall be composed of members chosen every second year by the people of the several states." Members of the House of Representatives are chosen by the people because their job is to represent the people. Since the population of a country changes over time, the framers of the Constitution allowed for those changes by requiring an enumeration every 10 years so the representatives could be apportioned properly. More on that later. Section 3 of Article 1 starts, "The Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state, chosen by the legislature thereof, for 6 years, and each senator shall have one vote." Now, on the other hand, the Senate was to be made up of an equal number from each state. Although the method of choosing electors was changed by the 17th Amendment, the role of the Senate is obvious from the original method of doing so, by the legislature of the state they were to represent. So the framers of the Constitution gave us this bicameral legislature with one house chosen by the people and the other chosen by the states. One house was to represent the people, the other house, the states. Now, to accommodate changes in population that would inevitably happen, we enumerate the people every 10 years so we can apportion the representatives properly. Now, back to the apportionment. See, today we focus on how the 435 seats in the House are divided up among the states, which is the definition of apportionment. However, the Constitution does not set a fixed limit on the number of representatives. Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3 states, "The number of representatives shall not exceed one for every 30,000, but each state shall have at least one representative." The 2020 census recorded a population in America of 331,449,281 residents. Now, with a little simple math, that means the House of Representatives should have at least 11,049 members. So why doesn't the House have 11,000 members? Because of a law Congress passed early in the 20th century. In 1911, Congress passed a routine apportionment act based on the 1910 census, setting the size of the House of Representatives to 433 members, up from 391, plus allowing two more members when the states of Arizona and New Mexico were added to the Union. During the debate on this legislation, concerns were raised that the House was growing too large, making it unwieldy and difficult to manage. Then in 1920, for the first time, Congress failed to apportion members in the House after a census. This led to the Permanent Apportionment Act of 1929, or at least I think it did. When I searched for the Permanent Apportionment Act, I was directed to Title II USC Section 2, but when I checked the statute, the text was omitted. There was only a note pointing to the 1911 law that set the size of the House at 435 members. So why all of this concern over an almost 100-year-old piece of legislation, of which I cannot even find the actual language? After all, if Congress cannot seem to get much done with only 435 members in the House, imagine if there were 11,000. Of course, there are plenty of people, myself included, who think life would be much better if Congress didn't do nearly as much as it does, especially since most of what they do is illegal. To quote the chairman of the House Committee on the Census in 1911, "Members are supposed to reflect the opinion and stand for the wishes of their constituents. If we make the ratio of persons per representative too large, the idea of representation becomes attenuated and less definite. the personal interest of the voter in his representative becomes less important to him, and we may lose something of the vital strength of our representative form of government. While limiting the number of members in the House may make it easier for them to get things done, it also makes it harder for them to fulfill their constitutional duty of representing the people of their district. When was the last time you tried to communicate with your House member? If you email or write a letter to your member, you'll probably get a form letter in reply. If you call their office, you'll get a staffer. And unless you have some serious pull, it's unlikely you'll get a face-to-face meeting, will you? Why? Well, there are probably plenty of reasons for this. One of them is undoubtedly how busy your representative is. With over 331 million Americans and only 435 members in the House, means each member represents over 750,000 people. It also means that if they spent only 5 minutes with each of their constituents, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, it would take over 7 years to meet them all. There just aren't enough hours in the day for your representative to actually know your opinion on a particular subject, not to mention your chance to petition them for a redress of grievance. Now, if your House member only represented 30,000 people, you might still have a hard time getting a meeting, but at least time would not be so much of an issue. They could spend 5 minutes with almost every person in their district every year, working only 9 to 5, 5 days a week. There was an attempt to limit the expansion of the House of Representatives in 1789. The first of the amendments Congress proposed to the states was never ratified. After the first enumeration required by the first article of the Constitution, there should be one representative for every 30,000 until the number shall amount to 100, after which the proportion shall be so regulated by Congress that there shall be not less than 100 representatives, nor less than one representative for every 40,000 persons until the number of representatives shall amount to 200. After which, the proportion shall so be regulated by Congress that there shall be not less than 200 representatives, nor more than one representative for every 50,000 persons. It seems that by 1929, Congress couldn't be bothered actually getting the consent of the governed. They thought that the House was large enough, so they simply passed a law. And that brings us back to the foundation we laid at the beginning of this video. The Constitution says we are to have one member of the House for every 30,000 people, and that has never been amended. Yes, Congress has apparently passed legislation limiting the size of the House to 435 members. But since that legislation is not pursuant to the Constitution, it is therefore repugnant to, and according to the Supreme Court, that law is void. Remember the Marbury versus Madison opinion? Thus, the particular phraseology of the Constitution of the United States confirms and strengthens the principle, supposed to be essential to all written constitutions, that a law repugnant to the Constitution is void, and that courts, as well as other departments, are bound by that instrument. If the law limiting the size of the House is void, doesn't that mean we should have over 11,000 members to represent us? So why don't we? In short, it's much like the people in the story of the Emperor's clothes. The American people are either afraid of or ignorant of the facts and are therefore unwilling to point out the obvious. Now, I haven't even found any evidence that this Permanent Apportionment Act of 1929 was even challenged in court, much less among the states. This lie has been going on for so long, most Americans have been gaslighted into believing it's true. This is one more example of the government in Washington, D.C. being out of control. At this point, I have no confidence that if the Permanent Apportionment Act were to be challenged in federal court, those in the judiciary would even recognize how repugnant it is. Now, should the House of Representatives have over 11,000 members? I'm not sure. What I do know is that it's not up to Congress to determine the size of the House. It is up to we, the people, through our states. Yet we were never consulted, neither have we consented to this change. It seems almost everyone from those elected to federal offices to the average everyday American has come to believe that whatever Congress does is not only legal, but the supreme law of the land. So I guess I must accept the role of the small boy, pointing out that when it comes to the acts of Congress, those emperors have no clothes. Now, by this time, you would be thinking, come on, Paul, what's the big deal? 435, 11,000, whatever that number is, what does it really matter? And it really comes down to an understanding of who's ultimately in charge. Do we, the people,
create our governments? Do we establish them to protect our rights? Do they only exercise the just powers that we have delegated to them or not? This shows itself in a myriad of different ways. I've already talked about how Congress has now assumed the power to issue subpoenas. Now, there's nothing in the Constitution that gives Congress the authority to issue subpoenas. They've created a special committee about the January 6th demonstration. But then again, there's nothing in the Constitution that gives Congress any investigatory powers except for it to deal with legislation. And since there's no legislative intent in this commission, again, Congress is just doing whatever it wants. So this is just another example of what happens when we, the people, let go of the reins and allow our representatives to do whatever they feel like. We've gone from a representative republic to truly an oligarchy where if you can get elected, well, you can get away with pretty much anything. And if you get yourself appointed to the Supreme Court, well, you're pretty much the ruler. And this shows itself, again, in so many little ways. So as I was talking about this idea of subpoenas, we have Representative Adam Schiff. He was talking about one of the Trump strategists, Steve Bannon, who refuses to answer to the subpoena. And again, the subpoena should have no legal authority. It is not a power of Congress to issue subpoenas. It is not a power of Congress to investigate criminal activity. Therefore, there's no legal reason for this. And if we had a actual justice system, the courts would look at this and throw this out. But no, Adam Schiff is all for proposing criminal contempt charges against Mr. Bannon. But it gets even worse. So he says that those criminal contempt charges would be, quote, a way of getting people's attention. So now we have federal subpoenas, illegal though they may be, being used for political ends, not legal ones. What does this have with the Apportionment Act? Simple. If we let Congress get away with setting its own size, setting its own rules, giving itself its own power, why are we surprised when those in Congress would use those levers of power for their own personal or political ends? It's the natural outcome. It's if you don't fix the problem when it's small, you can't complain when it gets big. If you don't deal with the sliver when it first gets infected, well, when the infection grows, you can't be surprised. And if you continue to ignore it to the point where you have to amputate the finger or possibly even the hand because we didn't deal with the problems when they're small. The 1929 Congress that assumed to itself the power to regulate its own size was the sliver. It was one of many slivers. The fact that we have a Congress that seems to do whatever it wants, assume the power of the executive to investigate crimes and the power of the judiciary to try crimes, comes from the fact that we haven't held those in Congress accountable. Our representatives seem much less interested in representing their constituents and much more interested in political power plays. Maybe that's why George Washington said political parties were so dangerous, or specifically, the alternate domination of one faction over another, sharpened by the spirit of revenge natural to party dissension, which in different ages and countries has perpetuated the most horrid enormities, is itself a frightful despotism. Yes, we are living in the despotism that we have allowed to fester in our country. But it's not the fault of those that are the infection. It is the fault of those of us who refuse to deal with the infection when it was small. You see, we love to talk about representative republics and democracies, but it still takes the people being involved, being engaged. It's not enough to show up and put a check mark or fill in a blank next to a name and figure you're done. They're your employees. And we need to treat them as such. We need to learn to not simply wind them up and set them loose, that we've created their offices. We established those positions. They only have power because we've allowed them to have power. And it's not simply that we created it and now they have it. No, no, no. We continue to allow them to have power. We continue to hire them to hold offices. They are our responsibility. And it's just as important that we hold them responsible for every action that they do as that we vote and choose them in the first place. So this is the type of thing where a little bit of history hopefully will encourage you to maybe take a closer look at your representative and ask if they're doing the job that you hired them for. And are they fulfilling the oath they took to support the Constitution of the United States? Now, you may ask yourself, Paul, where did this idea of talking about the apportionment acts come from? Well, it actually was a question that was asked. Now, I love questions. I love when people ask me questions, especially good, thoughtful questions. And a person asked me, he said, hey, would I research and do an episode on the Apportionment Act? Now, if you want to ask your own questions, well, there's a great way to do that. First, head to constitutionstudy.com. That's where you can find all sorts of information about the Constitution Study. You can find the video that I record about this, the article that I wrote. It is there for you to use. It is there for you to share. You want to share this with friends and family, go to constitutionstudy.com. Be my guest. It's there for you. But you can also ask a question. Now, right at the top on the menu bar, you can just click ask a question. It'll pop up a form and you can ask a question. And if you'd like me to cover it on the radio, on this radio program, we'll just make a note of that. Just say, hey, Paul, I'd love to hear this on the radio and I'll see what I can do. I can't promise I'll answer all questions, but I'll do my best. And if I can put it on the radio, so much the better. But I also love it if you would join my Q&A. See, twice a month, I hold a live Q&A for the people interested in the Constitution Study. I hold it the second and fourth Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Central Time. Now, you can find it on Rumble, YouTube, or Twitter as a live stream. And then all you have to do is put your question in the comment, and I'll be more than happy to answer it. But there's one other way which I think is really cool. And that is, I actually record this as a Zoom call. And if you can join the Zoom call, just register on the calendar. Right? You'll see the calendar on the right-hand side, or go to constitutionstudy.com/events, and you can register for the live Q&A. Now, you may ask yourself, Paul, why would I do the live Q&A? Why would I do the Zoom call? Why wouldn't I just sit there and lurk on YouTube? Well, the one nice thing about the Zoom call is it's an interactive discussion. You can ask your question. I can maybe get some clarification. We can have an actual discussion while other people listen. This is an important part of studying, is not simply throwing something out and waiting for an answer. It's that interaction. It's that interchange. And it's absolutely free. Again, just go to constitutionstudy.com/events, find the live Q&A, and register. Absolutely free. You'll get an email reminders as the events are coming up with links on how to join the Zoom call, and then just join and participate. Also, I want to let you know I'm going to be in the Tampa area early November. Right now, I'm booked on the 9th and the 10th. I'm still looking for more dates. If you want more information, please go to constitutionstudy.com/tour. Find out if I'm going to be near you. If you're in the Tampa area and you want to join, just check in there. There should be a link where you can find out more information. I'd love the chance to sit and talk with you. If you live anywhere between Nashville, Tennessee, and somewhere in Florida, well, maybe you'd like me to come speak to your group. Again, constitutionstudy.com/tour. There's a form at the bottom of the page. Fill that out. I will contact you, and we'll see if we can make it happen. I'm trying to get several dates in and around all of Florida, and I'm looking forward to meeting more and more people who are students of the Constitution, other constitutional scholars. And the way we do that is by finding each other and meeting each other. Now, before I head off to break, I want to remind you to check out HealthyCell.com. That's right. They've reinvented the vitamin. No longer a fistful of pills. It's easy to take a gel pack with vitamins designed to be absorbed at the cellular level and boost your immune system, help you sleep better, focus better, stay younger longer. And as an America Out Loud listener, you get 20% off your first order. Just go to healthycell.com/outloud and you can try any of their pill-free vitamin supplements. Now, they've got different formulas that do different things, but I don't know about you, but when I travel, I sometimes have a hard time sleeping, and I love Healthy Cell's REM sleep. I take it, and about 15, 20 minutes, I'm feeling drowsy, and I'm ready to go to sleep, get a good night's sleep, so I can wake up rested, refreshed, and meet more constitutional scholars to discuss this wonderful country that we live in. But again, you can get 20% off of your first order. Just go to healthycell.com/outloud or just simply use outloud at checkout for that 20% discount.
Let's get real. Let's get loud. On America Out Loud Talk Radio, this is McCullough Report. Are you tired of your tired vitamins? Consider Healthy Cell. These are pill-free vitamins that are in convenient gel packs. I like the Focus and Recall supplement. I use this a lot. You know, your brain uses a lot of energy and it depends on a variety of micronutrients and vitamins. Boost your short-term focus and long-term brain power with Healthy Cell's Focus and Recall vitamins. So go to healthycell.com, use the code OUTLOUD, all capital letters, OUTLOUD for a 20% off your first order of any Healthy Cell product. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
While the cancel culture is determined to destroy our history, bringing violence and terror to city streets, America Out Loud will enhance its own message of love and honor for the American traditions and constitutional values that have always been the backbone of what America means: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. You've rejoined the Constitution Study. Today, we're talking about representation. And not only our representation in Congress and the House of Representatives and how it's apportioned, but how do we treat our representatives? Do we treat them as employees? Do we hold them to their oath of office, or do we treat them more like a wind-up clock? You know, you vote for them, you wind them up, you let them loose, and in a couple years you go back and you vote again. Sadly, it seems many Americans are more the latter than the former. So I wasn't really surprised when I saw the information about this bipartisan bill designed to, quote-unquote, control big tech and restore competition. Now, I found this article, and they're talking about that the bill would help restore competition online by establishing common sense rules of the road for dominant digital platforms to prevent them from abusing their market power to harm competition, online businesses, and consumers, and from reducing incentives to innovate. Now, first of all, when everyone says, well, common sense rules, common sense laws, I always kind of shudder at that because common sense seems to be one of the rarest elements in this country, in any country. See, what many people think of as common sense, other people look at as irrational, illegal, unconstitutional. And my guess is this law is going to be more of the same. See, what they want to do is there are people that are unhappy with big tech. What they refer to as big tech, large technology corporations. Let's face it, they're talking YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, right? These large corporations that millions and millions of people use. In fact, sometimes billions of people use. Now, the legislation that's proposed, again, this is bipartisan. There are both Democrats and Republicans supporting this. They specifically would prohibit big tech platforms like Amazon, Google, and others from favoring their own products and services. So just imagine this. You start a business. Let's say you're making widgets. I don't care what the widget is, but you make a widget, and you think you make the best widget in the world. Now, I would naturally want to sell that widget. I'd like to sell more of those widgets. So if you're telling, if you come to, you know, for example, let's say you show up at Walmart. Now, is Walmart gonna tend to prefer that you buy Walmart stuff or Target stuff? It's really kind of simple, isn't it? Right? Walmart wants you to buy Walmart stuff. Target wants you to buy Target stuff. So they're saying that these people are saying it's unfair that companies actually favor their own products. They refer to it as abuse to favor their own products. Now, there have been some reports of things like Amazon has been basically, they would partner with a company, they start selling their product, they'd make their own knockoff version and then promote that. That's a whole nother issue. I'm not talking about that. You have Google, which, you know, tends to point people towards Google preferred products. That's kind of the nature of the business. You know, the idea of a business trying to promote itself above its rivals is the definition of competition. But here we have people saying, no, this is harms competition. Well, it what it harms are people who want their product without going through the competition of building the better mousetrap. And of course, this also ignores the fact that both Amazon, Google, and the other platforms have become havens of small businesses to sell their own products. You think about it, right? If you don't have to be a big warehouse store to sell your own product. You could actually have it stored and fulfilled right through Amazon for a small fee. You can advertise your product absolutely free by creating YouTube videos about it. These are all tools that actually help promote competition and business. But here's the part that I don't understand, or actually I understand. Here's the part that worries me. We're putting government in charge of what is and isn't fair. We're going to let politicians, people who we know lie to us for a living, determine what is quote-unquote common sense. In other words, some of the people with the least common sense in the world are going to be determining what is and is not common sense. Now, let's face it. If Google, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, if they have actually broken the law, well, then they should be prosecuted for it. But the fact that they've done a good job, that they've offered a platform, a product so much better than everybody else, that they own a large percentage of the market, doesn't make those actions evil. It doesn't make it discriminatory. What it makes it is good business. Does that mean that it's harder for somebody to be a competitor to Google or Apple or Amazon? Absolutely. In other words, they can't simply provide a similar product and expect the same market share. They actually have to provide a better product. That's the part that always seems to be missing. People aren't forced to do business with Amazon, Google, Facebook, Instagram. They do so voluntarily. There is no one holding a gun to your head saying you must search via Google or you go to jail. They do so voluntarily because Google created a very good product. Now, why don't I use Google? Because they've started to, I don't like the way they've configured their business. They have used their algorithms. You know, the biggest thing is they spy. Every free Google product you use, you're being spied on. They are searching, tracking, filtering. Now, they do it for a couple of reasons. One is, well, they use it to make better advertising, which is kind of a good thing, right? You know, if you're going to have to watch advertising, wouldn't it be nice if the advertising was actually something you might be interested in? But you see, then they sell that data and they give it over to the federal government without any warrant. So I'm not real thrilled with Google, which is why I try to avoid their products as much as possible. And I don't do business on Facebook because they kicked me off for actually talking about how what the Constitution says is the method the president gets elected. So they don't want to hear my stuff, so I don't do business with them. Is there a negative impact by me doing that? Yes, I have a negative impact. I could probably sell more stuff if I was willing to just shut up and do what Facebook wanted. But that's not who I am. And I've made that decision. And I suffer the consequence of that. But what we have here are we have millions of people that are unhappy with the manipulation that Facebook has used, but they're unwilling to walk away from Facebook. They want their cake and eat it too. So they're going to get the bully in Washington, D.C. to tell Facebook to behave the way they want. But you know what? Nobody ever seems to take the time to think about. What happens when your opponents have that power? All of these people who are complaining that, you know, Facebook is squashing conservative content, what happens when the lever, you know, we're going to get government to take control? What happens when the conservatives are in charge? Are they going to change the laws to disenfranchise the more progressive? So just imagine the power you're giving the government's trying to assume, the power to determine what private businesses, what traffic they can and cannot allow, how they're going about doing it, what is and isn't fair, what is and isn't common sense. Now, if we give that to government, just imagine your political enemy having that power against you. Are you still so sure you want to give them that type of power? And what about this? Now, back this summer in the House, Bill H.R. 4980 was proposed. This legislation states, the Secretary of Homeland Security acting through the Administrator of Transportation Security Administration shall take such actions as are necessary to ensure that any individual traveling on a flight that departs from or arrives to an airport inside the United States or a territory of the United States is fully vaccinated. Again, this is the House of Representatives. These are the representatives of the people. Everyone out there that's complaining about these vaccine mandates, what are your representatives doing about this? But again, we're talking about the abuse of representation. See, there is nothing in the Constitution that grants Congress the power to regulate travel. Now, they can regulate interstate commerce. They can regulate foreign commerce. But they have no legitimate authority to regulate interstate travel. Now, if they want to say, listen, if you are flying in or out of the country, there's a, you know, then maybe because you're dealing with a form of interstate commerce, but maybe you're not coming for commerce. Maybe you're coming to visit. Maybe you're coming, for things other than to conduct commerce. But to say that I'm here in Tennessee, if I want to fly to California, that I have to deny my right to liberty, my right to property of my body, my freedom in order to use an airline, well, that's not a power we delegated to the United States. This is another usurpation of powers. And, it, you know, to the point of, it's like we've become numb to this. It happens so often, so frequently, that we almost kind of become numb to it. Because you know what I'm not seeing? I'm not seeing an uproar against this. In fact, I heard somebody say that somewhere around, was it 40 to 60% of Americans approve of mandates? Of governments telling people they must take an experimental drug simply to participate in public life? Does the House of Representatives truly represent the will of the people? See, the thing about a constitutional republic is it's not simply the will of the people. That will is bound by their consent through the Constitution of the United States. And since nothing in the Constitution of the United States grants Congress the authority to make healthcare decisions, nothing in the Constitution of the United States grants Congress the authority to control travel, except possibly the commerce of interstate and international travel. But they can't control travel. Yet here they are again, telling the American people how best they should live their lives, without any constitutional authority to do so whatsoever. Sure, people are talking about the medical, the scientific. How about the fact that this is a crime? This law deprives people, if it were to become law, this bill were to become law, would deprive the American people of the liberty to travel without restrictions and the property to control their own body. Now, if this were anybody other than Congress, this would be a violation of 18 U.S.C. Section 242, a crime of depriving someone of a right protected by the Constitution of the United States. However, we cannot charge members of Congress for this because they're specifically protected in the Constitution from any criminal aspects of their privilege from arrest for anything they say on the as a member of Congress on the floor of the House of Congress. But why do we keep hiring them? That's the part that always gets me. Why do we keep hiring people who are criminals? People who are lying to us. People who are abusing the power to represent us, the powers we've given them to represent us. This is the part that I find most frustrating. It's the part that I think we need the most work. It's the education that becomes the bedrock foundation to understanding what your rights are and how to defend them and how to assert them. But when we're talking about representation, we're not simply talking about Congress. You have to remember, there are basically three levels of government in the United States. Yes, you have the federal government in Washington, D.C. You have your state government in your state house. You have your county, your city government as well. And we get represented at all three levels. Now, this is an interesting one because I found this actually out of the 10th Amendment Center. Apparently, there's been a bill filed in the Florida House and Senate that would require the governor to stop unconstitutional foreign combat deployments of the state's National Guard troops. Now, what does this mean? Well, I took a look at the legislation, the version coming out of the House, and it's pretty straightforward. Actually, it's interesting. They have what they call the whereas clauses, the situation that is being dealt with. And they actually go into some very interesting discussion. They talk about the fact that Congress has not officially declared war for over 70 years, that they quote George Washington, James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton, and all this. They eventually get down to the legislation, which says, get down to the important point. Notwithstanding any other provision of this chapter, the Florida National Guard and any member thereof may not be released from this state into active duty combat unless the United States Congress has made an official declaration of war or has taken an official action pursuant to Article 1, Section 8, Clause 15 of the United States Code to explicitly call forth the Florida National Guard and any member thereof for the enumerated purpose of expressing executing the laws of the Union, repelling an invasion, or suppressing an insurrection. It goes on to say, the governor shall take all actions necessary to comply with this section. Now, why is this interesting? At least interesting to me as a constitutional scholar. Well, it points out a couple of things. See, the Constitution does delegate to Congress the ability to declare war. Only Congress can declare war. That's Clause 12, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 12. They can declare war. But what's interesting is it doesn't say how to declare war. So it's when we talk about the war in Korea or Vietnam or Iraq or Afghanistan, they're not technically wars, but they are military engagements, and those were to a certain extent offensive military engagements. We were not attacked and responding. We went out to do this, but Congress never actually declared war. But back to the clause of the text. It's okay, they haven't declared war, but it also notes that in clause 15, it says that Congress shall provide for the calling forth of the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrection, and repel invasion. Now, this is where life is interesting because look at how many, you look at Iraq and Afghanistan, both Iraqs and Afghanistan, and you have the large use of the National Guard, of the militia. Now, federal law defines militia in two groups. There's the organized militia, which is the Guard and the Reserve. And there's the unorganized militia, which is pretty much everybody else with a gun. But the only thing Congress is supposed to call up the militia for is to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrection, and repel invasion. but they've been used for offensive actions overseas. And Florida says, you know what? We don't want this anymore. We did not authorize Congress to call it the militia to send people overseas to fight undeclared wars. So they're basically saying, our citizens, the citizens of Florida, remember, you are a citizen of your state before you're a citizen of the United States. It says, our citizens are not to be called into active duty in combat unless Congress has actually officially declared war. Or they've taken some action pursuant to the, again, enforcing the laws, repelling invasions, suppressing insurrection. So this is the state of Florida, the government of the state of Florida representing their citizens to say, listen, we've set limits on what Congress of the United States can do. The states ratified this. We are now telling our governor that you must comply with this section that says we aren't going to send our guard troops, we're not going to send our boys and girls to go fight actions that Congress wants unless they are pursuant to the Constitution. It was an interesting read. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I wouldn't mind seeing more states push back and say, no, you know, you just can't have these wars all over the place and expect the guard to fill in. Because again, remember, the militia, they're there to protect us. They are to maintain the security of a free state. The Second Amendment, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. They're there to protect our states. They're not there to project foreign policy. So I like this, and I bring this up because it's a situation where the representatives in the legislature of Florida are telling the governor to represent the citizens of Florida and say, no, we will not allow our boys and girls to be pulled off unless Congress actually follows the rules and either declares war or calls them up for some other constitutionally authorized purpose. This is a state pushing back and saying, no, we're not going to do this anymore. And in a way, isn't that a form of representation? Because you think about it, the preamble of the Constitution says, we the people ordain and establish the Constitution, but it didn't become legally binding until 3/4 of the states ratified it. And only the states have the legal authority to modify it. So we have the states representing the interests of the citizens of their state and protecting the citizens of their state. And doing so saying, Congress, we're only going to do it if you follow the rules. And this is often referred to as nullification. It's not technically nullification. If a majority of the states were to say Congress, you can no longer call up the guard for overseas actions unless you declare war, that would be nullification. So this isn't a state saying Congress doesn't have the authority to call up the National Guard. It's basically saying we're only going to comply with legitimate calling of the National Guard, which is defined as a declaration of war or for the purpose described in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 15, which is all domestic, right? Executing the laws of the United States, suppressing insurrection, and repelling invasion. So this is the understanding of why understanding the Constitution and the limitations is important, because I'm kind of curious. I want to keep an eye on this. I kind of like this legislation. In fact, I may even send a copy of it to my state rep and state senator, see if they want to propose something similar to that. One more thing I want to cover before we call it a day today, and that gets back to this insanity of referring to parents as domestic terrorists. Now, first of all, I want to make sure that we're using the proper terminology. You know me, words matter. So Merriam-Webster defines a terrorist as someone who commits terror or terrorism, which is what they define as the systematic use of terror, especially as a means of coercion. This is an important point. One, you have to terrorize. You have to scare people to coerce people. Now, 17 attorneys general have written the Biden administration and the Department of Justice rebuking them for their actions in referring to parents complaining at school boards as terrorists. Even if these parents did threaten people, that does not make them terrorists. If that were true, then every mugger would be a terrorist. Everybody who commits assault would be a terrorist. Every incident of road rage would be a terrorist. Now, the letter these attorneys general sent basically said the memorandum coming out of the Department of Justice and Attorney General Garland really promises a set of actions designed to chill and suppress lawful dissent by parents voiced during local school board meetings by characterizing them as unlawful and threatening. So it goes on to say they are based on a flawed premises that there's been a nationwide spike in threats of violence against school administrators, board members, teachers, and staff. They violate the First Amendment rights of parents to address school administrators, boards, teachers, and staff on educational matters by seeking to criminalize lawful dissent and intimidate parents into silence. They intrude on the well-recognized First and 14th Amendment rights of the parents or guardians to direct the upbringing of their children by intimidating parents away from raising concerns about the education of their children. You know, here we go. These are neat. These are the facts. And they go on to say, to be sure, anyone who attacks or threatens violence against school administrators, board members, teachers, or staff should be prosecuted. However, in its letter demanding action, the NSBA fails to document a single legitimate instance of violence. And even if it did, there are sufficient criminal and civil remedies already available in all 50 states and territories. So what do we have here? We have 17 of the 50 states through their attorneys general standing up to the federal government saying, listen, you've overstepped the mark. You've gone too far. Now, the question is, what are they going to do about it? Now, they go on to point to laws and to Supreme Court cases that say, listen, this doesn't meet the definition of terrorism. This is not the speech is protected by the Constitution. Parents have the right to speak, even emotionally, to their school boards. On and on. The stuff from the NSBA is garbage. They go on and on and on and on. Now, here's the interesting part. I get to the last paragraph. Make that the last two paragraphs. It goes, despite the primary role of parents in directing the education and upbringing of their children, the NSBA letter and the October 4th 2021 memorandum seek to intimidate parents under the threat of being investigated as domestic terrorists from exercising their rights. To that end, we request that you immediately withdraw the October 4th, 2021 memorandum to immediately cease any further action designed to intimidate parents from expressing their opinions on the education of their children and demand that you respect their First Amendment rights of freedom of speech and to raise their children. Now, to me, this is maybe step one in an action, right? It says, listen, it's what in legal terms, I believe it's called a demand letter, right? They request that you withdraw and you stop trying to intimidate parents. Now, hopefully that is a prelude to saying, if you don't withdraw the memorandum, if you continue to intimidate parents, we're going to do something about it. And that's the part I'm kind of waiting and seeing, right? So this is... this letter is it's a legal step. Hopefully it's not the last step. Well, let me phrase it. If Merrick Garland does not withdraw the memorandum, if they continue to attempt to intimidate parents, I hope this is not the last state. I believe this to me is demand letter. Will probably... possibly be followed up by an actual lawsuit, which should be heard by the Supreme Court directly, since the United States is a party. But more importantly, I'm waiting to see the legislatures and the governors of these states actually stand up and say, we will defend our parents from this intimidation. Now, this may be, again, the polite first step. First, we warn you, then we stand. So if you live in any of these states, now this was originally drafted, I guess, by the Attorney General of Indiana. It was assigned on by the Attorney Generals of Alabama, Arizona, Arkansas, Georgia, Kansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri, Montana, Ohio, Oklahoma, South Carolina, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, and Utah. If you live in one of those states, do me a favor, send a note, send a letter to your attorney general. You can find their information on the state website. Thank them for signing on to this. And I'd probably copy the governor as well. Thank them for signing on to this, but also encourage them to hold fast to their duty to protect the citizens of their state. That should the federal government, should Merrick Garland not follow their advice, one, they should be willing to sue. Two, the governor should be willing to use the executive branch and troops and the National Guard to defend the parents of their state against a criminal intrusion by the federal government. Now, I pray it doesn't get that far, but, you know, what we say, pray for the best, prepare for the worst. We need to tell our attorneys general when they're doing something right. That's why I say contact them, let them know that you appreciate this. If you live in one of the other states that did not sign on to this, maybe you should ask your attorneys general why. Why would you not sign on to this? Why would you not be a part of protecting the citizens of your state, enforcing the laws of your state against the criminal actions of the federal government? It may be worth a little bit of time and effort from that standpoint. But that is the duty of a citizen in a republic. We must be engaged. We must hold our representatives accountable. And that includes the people in the executive branch who are exercising the laws that we have created. Now, America Out Loud plays on the iHeartRadio network, and you can listen on our media player from any web browser anywhere in the world. You can listen to our best-in-class apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And now, you can even listen to the podcast of previous episodes on those very same apps. So please, join me next time for the Constitution Study.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors, and have a few good friends.